Thank you. some noise and tear down the place.
Let's go.
All of the crew that's on the kind of stand well, cause you know when this time of morning everything nice.
seduced by the image of reality. When I would look through magazines as a small child, I used to think that there must be a magical world somewhere where everything looked and was perfect. I could see pictures from it in those pages, the smoky air of dimly lit rooms heavy with drama as the young models lounged in designer fashions. That is where excitement and adventure is to be found, I thought, in the world where every room is flawlessly decorated and every woman's wardrobe is picked and matched with daring and finesse. I resolved to have an adventurous life of my own and began looking for those rooms and women right away. And though I've discovered since then that romance and excitement rarely come hand in hand with the images of them that are presented to us, usually the opposite is true, that adventure is to be found precisely where there is no time or energy for keeping up appearances. I still catch myself sometimes thinking that everything would be perfect if I only lived in that picturesque log cabin with matching rugs. Whatever each of us may be looking for, we all tend to pursue our own desires by pursuing images, symbols of the thing we desire. We buy leather jackets when we want rebellion and danger. We purchase fast cars not for the sake of driving at high velocities, but to recapture our lost youth. When we want to live in a different world, we buy political pamphlets and bumper stickers. Somehow, we assume that having all the right accessories will get us the perfect lives. And as we construct our lives, we tend to do it according to an image, a pattern that has been laid out before us. Hippie, businessman, housewife, punk. Why do we think so much about images today, rather than concentrating on reality, on our lives and emotions themselves? One of the reasons that images have attained so much significance in this society is that, unlike activities, images are easy to sell. Advertising and marketing, which are designed to invest products with a symbolic value that will attract customers, have transformed our culture. Corporations have been spreading propaganda designed to make us believe in the magic powers of their commodities for generations now. Deodorants offer popularity, soda offers youth and energy, jeans offer sex appeal. At our jobs, we exchange our time, energy, and creativity for the ability to buy these symbols, and we keep buying them, for of course no quantity of cigarettes can really give anyone sophistication. Rather than satisfying our needs, these products multiply them. For to get them, we must sell our lives away. We keep going back, not knowing another way, hoping that the new product, self-help books, punk rock records, that vacation cabin with matching rugs, will be the one that will fix everything. We are easily persuaded to chase these images because it is simply easier to change the scenery around you than it is to change your own life. How much less trouble, how much less risky it would be if you could make your life perfect just by collecting all the right accessories. No participation necessary. The image comes to embody all the things you desire, and you spend all your time and energy trying to get the details right. The bohemian tries to find the perfect black beret and the right poetry readings to attend. The frat boy has to be seen with the right friends, at the right parties, drinking the right beers, and wearing the right informal dress shirts, rather than pursuing the desires themselves. For it is easier to identify yourself with a prefabricated image than to identify exactly what you want in life. But if you really want adventure, an Australian hunting jacket won't suffice. And if you really want romance, dinner and a movie with the most popular girl at your school might not be enough. Fascinated as we are by images, our values have come to revolve around a world we can never actually experience. There's no way into the pages of the magazine. There's no way to be the archetypical punk or the perfect executive. We're trapped out here in the real world forever. And yet we keep looking for life in pictures, in fashions, in spectacles of all kinds, and anything we can collect or watch instead of doing. We look for life in the image of life. Watching from the sidelines. The curious thing about a spectacle is how it immobilizes the spectators. Just like the image, it centers their attention, their values, and ultimately their lives around something outside of themselves. It keeps them occupied without making them active. It keeps them feeling involved without giving them control. You can probably think of 1,000 different examples of this. Television programs, action movies, magazines that give updates on the lives of celebrities and superstars, spectator sports, representative democracy, the Catholic Church. A spectacle also isolates the people whose attention it commands. Many of us know more about the fictitious character of popular sitcoms than we know about the lives and loves of our neighbors. For even when we talk to them, it is about television shows, the news, and the weather. Thus, the very experiences and information that we share in common as spectators of the mass media serve to separate us from one another. It is the same at a football game. Everybody watching from the bleachers is a nobody, regardless of who they are. They may be sitting next to each other, but all eyes are focused on the field. If they speak to each other, it is almost never about each other, but about the game that is being played before them. And although football fans cannot participate in the events of the game they are watching, or exert any real influence over them, They attach the utmost importance to these events and associate their own needs and desires with the outcome in a most unusual way. Rather than concentrating their attention on things that have a real bearing on their desires, they reconstruct their desires to revolve around the things they pay attention to. Their language even conflates the achievements of the team they identify themselves with their own actions. "We scored a goal! We won!" shout the fans from their seats and sofas. This stands in stark contrast to the way people speak about the things that go on in their own cities and communities. "They're building a new highway," we say about the new changes in our neighborhood. "What will they think of next?" we say about the latest advances in scientific technology. Our language reveals that we think of ourselves as spectators in our own societies. But it's not they, the mysterious other people, who have made the world the way it is. It is we, humanity ourselves. No small team of scientists, city planners, and rich bureaucrats could have done all the working and inventing and organizing that it has taken for us to transform this planet. It has taken and still takes all of us working together to do this. We are the ones doing it every day. And yet most of us seem to feel that we can have more control over football games than we can over our own cities, our jobs, even our own lives. We might have more success in our pursuit of happiness if we start really trying to participate. Instead of accepting the role of passive spectator sports, society, and life, it is up to each of us to figure out how to play an active and significant part in creating the worlds around us and within us. Perhaps one day we can build a new society in which we all will be involved together in the decisions that affect the lives we lead. Then we will be able to truly choose our own destinies. What's the point of doing anything if nobody's watching? We all want to be famous, to be seen, frozen, preserved in the media, because we've come to trust what is seen more than what is actually lived. Somehow we've gotten everything backwards, and image seems more real to us than experience. To know that we really exist, that we really matter, we have to see ghosts of ourselves preserved in photographs, on television shows and videotapes, in the public eye. And when you go on vacation, what do you see? Scores of tourists with video cameras screwed to their faces, as if they're trying to suck all of the real world into the two-dimensional world of images, spending their time off seeing the world through a tiny glass lens. Sure, turning everything that you could experience with all five senses into recorded information that you can only observe from a distance, detached, offers you the illusion of having control of your life. You can rewind and replay them over and over until everything looks ridiculous. But what kind of life is that? What's the point of watching anything if nobody's doing?
As much as you can do just to say hello. Have you got to stick your head inside that book? Oh, you've noticed I'm getting a bit spanned and too low. It's such a beautiful evening. Oh, would you like to go out? Oh, pardon me for breathing. You know, you walk a different way each night. To avoid the men on the building side. We waited half an hour for you to come. Oh well, you missed your dad and the tea's now overdone. It's only part of loving. Please don't accuse me of making something out of nothing. He's a good-looking kid, I think I've worked that bit out. And he seems to have the same desires as you. But if he's that much for now, then I'm not laughing too. It's such a beautiful evening. Oh, would you like to go out? Oh, pardon me for breathing. I can't help the way that I act. It's only part of loving. Please don't you tell me that I'm making something out.
is for anarchy. No gods. Once, flipping through a book on child psychology, I came across a chapter about adolescent rebellion. It suggested that in the first phase of a child's youthful rebellion against her parents, she may attempt to distinguish herself from them by accusing them of not living up to their own values. For example, if they taught her that kindness and consideration are important, she will accuse them of not being compassionate enough. In this case, the child has not yet developed herself or her own values. She still accepts the values and ideas that her parents passed on to her, and she is only able to assert her identity inside of that framework. It is only later, when she questions the very beliefs and morals that were presented to her as gospel, that she can become a freestanding individual. Far too many of us so-called radicals and revolutionaries show no signs of going beyond that first stage of rebellion. We criticize the actions of those in the mainstream and the effects of their society upon people and animals. We attack the ignorance and cruelty of their system, but we rarely stop to question the nature of what we all accept as morality. Could it be that this morality, which we think we can judge their actions, is itself something that should be criticized? When we claim that the exploitation of animals is morally wrong, what does that mean? Are we perhaps just accepting their values and turning these values against them, rather than creating moral standards of our own? Maybe right now you're saying to yourself, what do you mean, create moral standards of our own? Something is either morally right or it isn't. Morality isn't something you can make up. It's not a matter of mere opinion. Right there, you're accepting one of the most basic tenets of the society that raised you, that right and wrong are not individual valuations, but fundamental laws of the world. This idea, holdover from a deceased Christianity, is at the center of our civilization. If you're going to question the establishment, you should question it first. Where does the idea of moral law come from? Once upon a time, almost everyone believed in the existence of God. This God ruled over the world. He had absolute power over everything in it, and he had set down his laws that all human beings had to obey. If they did not, they would suffer the most terrible punishments at his hands. Naturally, most people obeyed the laws as well as they could, their fear of eternal suffering being stronger than the desire for anything forbidden. Because everyone lived according to the same laws, they could agree upon what morality was. It was the set of values decreed by God's laws. Thus, good and evil, right and wrong, were decided by the authority of God, which everyone accepted out of fear. One day, people began to wake up and realize that there was no such thing as God after all. There was no hard evidence to demonstrate his existence, and few people could see any point in having faith in the irrational any longer. God pretty much disappeared from the world. Nobody feared him or his punishments anymore. But a strange thing happened. Though these people had the courage to question God's existence, and even deny it to the ones who still believed in it, they didn't dare to question his morality that his laws had mandated. Perhaps it just didn't occur to him. Everyone had been raised to hold the same beliefs about what was moral, and had come to speak about right and wrong in the same way, so maybe they just assumed it was obvious what was good and what was evil, whether God was there to enforce it or not. Or perhaps people had become so used to living under these laws that they were afraid to even consider the possibility that the laws didn't exist any more than God did. This left humanity in an unusual position. Though there was no longer an authority to decree certain things absolutely right or wrong, they still accepted the idea that some things were right or wrong by nature. Though they no longer had faith in a deity, they still had faith in a universal moral code that everyone had to follow. Though they no longer believed in God, they were not yet courageous enough to stop obeying his orders. They had abolished the idea of a divine ruler, but not the divinity of his code of ethics. This unquestioning submission to the laws of a long-departed heavenly master has been a long nightmare from which the human race is only just beginning to awaken. God is dead, and with him, moral law. Without God, there is no longer any objective standard by which to judge good and evil. This realization was very troubling to philosophers a few decades ago, but it hadn't really had much of an effect in other circles. Most people still seem to think that a universal morality can be grounded in something other than God's laws, and what is good for people, and what is good for society, and what people feel called upon to do. But explanations of why these standards necessarily constitute universal moral law are hard to come by. Usually the arguments for the existence of moral law are emotional rather than rational. But don't you think rape is wrong? Moralists ask, as if a shared opinion were a proof of a universal truth. But don't you think people need to believe in something greater than themselves? They appeal, as if needing to believe in something can make it true. Occasionally, they even resort to threats. But what would happen if everyone decided that there is no good or evil? Wouldn't we all kill each other? The real problem with the idea of universal moral law is that it asserts the existence of something that we have no way to know anything about. Believers in good and evil would have us believe that there are moral truths. That is, there are things that are morally true of this world, in the same way that it is true that the sky is blue. They claim, it is true of this world that murder is morally wrong, just as it is true that water freezes at 32 degrees. But we can investigate the freezing temperature of water. We can measure it and agree together that we have arrived at some kind of objective truth, insofar as such a thing is possible. On the other hand, what do we observe if we want to investigate whether it is true that murder is evil? There is no tablet of moral law on a mountaintop for us to consult. There are no commandments carved into the sky above us. All we have to go on are our own instincts and the words of a bunch of priests and other self-appointed moral experts, many of whom don't even agree. As for the words of priests and moralists, if they can't offer any hard evidence from this world, why should we believe their claims? And regarding our instincts, if we feel that something is right or wrong, that may make it right or wrong for us, but that's not proof that it's universally good or evil. Thus, the idea that there are universal moral laws is mere superstition. It is a claim that things exist in this world which we can never actually experience or learn anything about, and we would do well not to waste our time wondering about things we can never know anything about. When two people fundamentally disagree over what is right or wrong, there is no way to resolve the debate. There is nothing in this world to which they can refer to see which one is correct, because there really are no universal moral laws, just personal evaluations. So the only important question is where your values come from. Do you create them for yourself, according to your own desires, or do you accept them from someone else who has disguised their opinions as universal truths? Haven't you always been a little suspicious of the idea of universal moral truths anyway? This world is filled with groups and individuals who want to convert you to their religions, their dogmas, their political agendas, their opinions. Of course, they will tell you that one set of values is true for everybody, and of course they will tell you that their values are the correct ones. Once you're convinced that there is only one standard of right and wrong, they're only a step away from convincing you that their standard is the right one. How carefully we should approach those who would tell us the idea of universal moral law, then. Their claim that morality is a matter of universal moral law is at base just a devious way to get us to accept their values, rather than forging values of our own which might conflict with theirs. So, to protect ourselves from the superstitions of the moralists and the trickery of the evangelists, let us be done with the idea of moral law. Let us step forward into a new era in which we will make values of our own rather than accepting moral laws out of fear and obedience. Let this be our new creed. There is no universal moral code that should dictate human behavior. There is no such thing as good or evil. There is no universal standard of right and wrong. Our values and morals come from us and belong to us, whether we like it or not. So we should claim them proudly for ourselves as our own creations, rather than seeking some external justification for them.
Right by itself, number one. Right by itself, number two. Right, 46, 47.
Yeah. Hallo, lieve luisteraar. We zijn geland op de Valkenburgerstraat, op de stoep van het Rode Kruis. Om aandacht voor die directeur van dat kinderziekenhuis, die zonder enige vorm van beschuldiging of wat dan ook gevangen is gezet, gemarteld wordt in de Palestijnse gevangenis. En het is hoog tijd dat daar actie ondernomen wordt. Hallo, we zijn live op Radio Patapool.
English is good.
Ah, English. Yeah, we're live on Radio Patapool. It's a free radio. Okay. So what's going on here today?
We are here in front of the Red Cross. We want to say free prisoner first, and the free Hussam Abu Safiya, who is a doctor who was doing him work in Gaza, and the Israeli army going to the hospital and arrested him and put him in the jail. No anybody knows something about him, what him situation, the healthy in the prison.